Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Before we begin, I'd like to mention that this segment will deal with eating disorders. And if this isn't the right time for you to hear the segment, you can download it later online or on your podcasting app. And at any time you feel like you need support, please call the National Eating Disorders Helpline. That number is 1-800-931-2237. From an early age, our next guest had strong reactions to food. As a baby, she refused rice cereal. She grew up with an extreme aversion to fruit. She used to order snow cones with no flavoring at birthday parties, just the ice. And when Susan Burton hit puberty, what would have been described in an old school way as being maybe a picky eater, quickly morphed into a dangerous, disordered eating. First anorexia, then binge eating. She describes how she thought about her relationship to food in her new memoir. She wrote, "Hunger, that was my trick. There was no gum chewing or fizzy water or fiber. That was the whole thing of my anorexia. Just don't eat. I was empty. Being empty meant I was always ready, always prepared, empty for exercise, empty in case of an emergency. I was always ready for surgery, ready to go under, ready for general, empty enough to go out at night and have room for a Frosty, even though that was not a thing I would ever eat. Alcoholics had to quit drinking to right themselves. I had to quit food. I didn't see the illogic in this. I didn't see the peril. I had restored order and I devoted myself to maintaining it. If the purge that follows a binge is kind of a ritual purification, anorexia was mine. I wouldn't get my period again for another year and a half." Susan Burton chronicles her struggles in a new memoir titled Empty. And if you public radio listeners are thinking, wow, that name sounds familiar, it's because Susan is an editor at This American Life. Empty is her first book. Susan, welcome to All of It.
Hi, Allison. Thank you so much for having me.
So when you sat down to write this memoir, that's a scary experience for whomever's trying to relive and rethink and reexamine their lives. So when you sat down to write it, what really scared you?
It first scared me. I mean, I didn't actually set out to write about my eating disorders. I set out to write a very different book, one that was meant to be a cultural history of teenage girlhood intertwined with some stories from my own adolescence. But as soon as I started writing that cultural history, I found myself writing this very personal history of my eating disorders, and the book became something very different, very raw, not what I'd intended it to be, in part because the secret of my adolescent binge eating was one I'd never told. And so what scared me was not only revealing that old shame, but what scared me was that I wanted to write about it so badly, if that makes sense. It was very hard to admit that this was the story I wanted to tell more than any other, that this stuff was still so charged for me, that it still meant something to me.
As someone whose job, whose profession is to edit a program that's so well known for its storytelling and its story structure, what have you observed about successful storytelling, especially deep, intimate storytelling that you were able to use in your own story?
That's a great question. I mean, radio, like, structure and pacing is very different than the structure and pacing of a book. But the imperative to tell detailed, intimate, honest stories about one's life is the same in both mediums. And so I've worked on lots of stuff as an editor or producer at This American Life that kind of inspired me with its bravery and showed me the kind of work I wanted to do. And in fact, at times when I was sort of too scared to be writing my own story, almost made me kick myself. Like, this is the work that means so much to me. Why am I not doing this too?
You use the word shame. And you wrote in your book, "The fact that I was ashamed of my own story was among the reasons I finally decided to tell it." What was the shame? What were you ashamed of?
The nature of the shame, I think, shifted over time. I think in the beginning, I was ashamed of the behavior itself. I was ashamed of the binging. I was ashamed of the image of a woman in a kitchen stuffing her face with food. But, you know, that was my experience. I was a woman in a kitchen. I was angry. I was stuffing my face with food. And I wanted to write about that experience with complexity and seriousness. I didn't want to diminish it or mock it or make fun of it, which is often what we do with that image. Mm-hmm. So that was like the first shame I had to combat.
You speak about a sort of a hierarchy of eating disorders, and that binge eating was somewhere towards the bottom. What is this hierarchy as you understand it? I don't know anything about this, and why does it exist?
Well, it's so bulimia and anorexia, I think, are the two eating disorders that most people know. When I was growing up in the 1980s, those were the ones that were mm-hmm. on after school specials and like in 17 magazine. And binge eating, it wasn't out there in the same way. It wasn't named for, at least for me as a teenage girl. It didn't become a formal eating disorder diagnosis until 2013. And so I think a lot of people still don't know about it. I think that there's something in bulimia and anorexia. They're very extreme illnesses. And binge eating, maybe it can seem sort of softer or JV. But binge eating is compulsive and enduring and destructive. I think a lot of people think of it, you know, just think of the way we use the word binge. We binge on a season of Netflix, or we binge on like the chocolate chip cookies we make. There's a lack of seriousness with which we use that word that I think somehow carries over into the illness itself.
My guest is Susan Burton. The name of her memoir is Empty. You made a choice in the memoir not to reveal your actual weight. There's never a number given. Why did you make that choice?
So for people who are vulnerable to eating disorders, numbers can be very triggering, not only weights, but like calorie counts. So I wanted to be sensitive to that. And also, you know, eating disorders are not in the end about the numbers. In the same way, they're not just about food, right? They're about using food to manage feeling. And the number has this symbolic power. But the number is not what your eating disorder is about in the end. The number is, the eating disorder is about whatever pain you're using it to cope with.
However, you do write very harshly about your own physical appearance and description. I started to get mad at you for being so mean to yourself. I was like, Susan, take it down. You know, you refer to yourself as looking like a sea lion and moon-faced. And why were your descriptions so harsh? Are you a reliable narrator here?
That's a good question. I mean, my eating disorders, I mean, those years for me were characterized by self-loathing, by hate, by anger. And that is what's coming through in those pages. When it comes to my body, I no longer have that kind of self-loathing, but the self-loathing around food took longer to undo. So for example, I started therapy a year and a half ago. It took me a really long time to get there. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things my therapist had me do was write down the food I ate and the feeling I had around it. And I was struck by how often I was writing sentences about anger and self-loathing in a way that almost sounded like my adolescent journals. I hadn't realized how attached those emotions were to food for me still.
Also in the book, I mean, part of going back to the body, though, is as a young woman, as a girl, you observe a lot about other people's bodies, and you mm-hmm. notice the way people talk about other people's bodies. Why were you at that time so involved and so invested in the body?
I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I think that there are a number of things. I mean, one of them was I was from a family where there was a lot of attention to appearance and size. A famous story we used to tell about my grandmother was the time she and my younger sister and I were back to school shopping, and we were in a little dressing room, and my grandmother clapped her hands together and just exulted, "I'm so glad I have thin grandchildren." And it became like this family joke, but there's a real truth to it. Being thin mattered in our family. I think also the fact that I reached puberty a lot earlier than almost everyone around me had a huge amount to do with my self-consciousness about my body. So by the time I was 10, I had my period, I had hips and breasts and a waist. You know, I remember it's so interesting how much of it is caught up in shopping, but I remember another back-to-school shopping with my mother and the saleswoman looking at me when I came out of the dressing room and say, "Oh, doesn't she have the cutest little figure?" And it was meant as a compliment, right? It's not the story you hear where somebody's shaming a girl because she's you know, what that person perceives to be too heavy. She was complimenting my body, but she was drawing attention to my body. And I think in a lot of ways, anorexia was a way to, you know, get rid of that body.
When was the first time you really consciously went on a diet?
The summer I was 9. I have a very vivid memory of there was another little girl on my swim team, and she was very skinny, and the leg holes of her swimsuit gaped, mm-hmm. and I wanted the leg holes of my swimsuit to gape. And there was one week when I was 9 years old that I remember just eating less, just sitting at the dinner table and just sort of looking at the food on my plate. And after a while, the food became absurd. And why would I eat it? And standing up from the table and feeling this kind of power. And to say these things now actually scares me a little bit. It scares me in part because I don't want it to sound like I'm romanticizing any of this. But saying it brings the old power back. And I think, you know, after that week, I went back to sort of eating normally, which in those years was unusually restrictive. Like you said in your intro, I was a very picky little girl. But there was a power I derived from refusal, from rejection, from self-denial very early.
Was part of this need for control a reaction to your family life disintegrating, your parents divorced, and you moved around a bunch?
For sure, yeah. I mean, looking back, I do see my eating disorders as very connected to, they were a way to cope with the pain of my parents' divorce. They were a way to cope with the anger about my parents' divorce. I couldn't express my anger at my parents, and I turned that anger back in on myself, most particularly with the binging, which had a real ferocity. I mean, even in, you know, stuffing blue corn chips in my mouth and the tips of the chips like pricking the inside of my mouth, or biting on a cookie and feeling like I'd broken my tooth. Like there were moments when it was painful in a way. It was a very angry behavior.
Oh my gosh, well, the way you write about the binge eating is harrowing. I mean, it can make one queasy to read how you went about this binge eating. What did you feel like before you started to binge?
That's such a good question, because when I tell a story of a binge, I do always try and start it before the binge itself, because the eating disorder is not just a way to manage weight, but a way to manage feeling. I mean, I would feel, you know, it could be a day at school when all my friends had left for lunch without me. And that sounds very small, but it was something that made me feel isolated and alone and unwanted, and wanting something I hadn't gotten. You know, a binge often followed an encounter with somebody that hadn't gone as I'd planned. You know, I didn't feel as close to that person, or I'd said something that, you know, was so silly that, to use the words I would have used then, made me hate myself. And eating was a way not to feel anything at all in that moment. You know, when I was eating, I didn't have to think until I was finished binging. And then what I had to think about was different, right? Because after a binge, I felt so much regret and self-loathing and fear that I never dealt with any of the feelings that had precipitated the binge in the first place.
My guest is Susan Burton. We're discussing her new memoir, Empty. We'll have more with Susan after a quick break. This is All of It. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, and I'm continuing my conversation with Susan Burton, the author of the memoir Empty. And we do want to mention, if you're just joining us, that this segment is dealing with disordered eating and eating disorders. If this isn't the right time for you to hear this segment, you can download it later online or in your podcasting app. Or if you're listening and you feel at some point you need support or need to talk to someone, you can call the National Eating Disorders Helpline at 1-800-931-2000. 2237. Susan, one of the things that was, so many things were interesting in the memoir, but one that really struck me was when you were at home and you were doing this binge eating, there wasn't a lot of conversation about it, but at one point you described just eating an entire, I think it was a tray of brownies. And the next day, I think it's the next day, your mom just says, hey, those were meant for a school event. Did anyone ever discuss with you when you were binging about the food being missing? Did it ever come up?
That was the single time it came up, which is why that moment is so potent for me and why I wrote about it in the book. And, you know, now that you say it, I haven't, my mother has read the book. She didn't know that I was binging during those years. I haven't asked her whether she remembers that specific moment, but that in my mind was the moment I ever, you know, I felt I came closest to sort of being found out. I was very good at hiding. You know, eating disorders are very isolating, and when you have them, you're very invested in hiding.
How did you balance throughout this period in your life that you come from a family of high achievers, you're an incredibly high achiever, you went to incredibly competitive college, you've got had a terrific career, if anybody goes down the Google rabbit hole with you. How did you balance the fact that you were a successful person sort of on paper, but you were having all these difficulties personally?
I mean, you know, the eating disorders, I mean, so you work, you and I both work in radio. So, mm-hmm. So you'll understand what I'm talking about. My eating disorders, I thought of them as like a Pro Tools session. So Pro Tools is the sound editing software, and the eating disorders were this track that I could not turn down. So I could not lower the volume on this track. Mm. You know, sometimes I could like pull it down slightly in the mix, but it was always there. I could never delete the track from the session. So I was doing all this other stuff. But my attention was often consumed by food. You know, I was preoccupied with it in a way I didn't want to be, and it limited me from doing work I wanted to do, from it cut me off from intimacy, from experience. It sort of organized my choices, and eventually I came to a point where I just wanted to adjust the position of that track in the session.
You mentioned a few moments when you thought about revealing your struggle, whether it was telling your mom or your friend. What stopped you from talking to people who cared about you?
I think shame. I think I had this conviction that I was going to work this all out by myself and then tell someone. And in a way, even writing this book is sort of a symptom of that. You know, I was going to set this down on paper, and then I was going to tell. Then I was going to get help for it. I think it was shame. And I think I imagined telling so much, but I didn't always imagine what came next. I think if I'd imagined telling would lead to healing, lead to working to recovery, which is where I am now, I might have been more motivated to say.
When was the first time you told someone you were struggling with disordered eating?
Gosh, It's a hard question to answer because I, as an adult, didn't understand how entrenched this stuff was for me, I think. Mm-hmm. Probably until I'm 46 now, and I started therapy a year and a half ago when I was 45. And I sort of thought I was there, you know, telling about the history of my disordered eating, but it soon became clear to me that this stuff was very much a part of my present, even though mm-hmm. I wasn't binging anymore, even though I was, you know, getting my period most months, my life was still limited by food.
What do you consider to be your first, what was your first step towards recovery, towards doing something that would release you from these binds of this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the most important thing writing this book did was to get me to start talking, was to get me to therapy. And so I would say that therapy, for sure, talk therapy is the first step in my recovery. And, you know, when people ask me, I have a loved one struggling with this or I'm struggling with this, the thing I say is, you know, anything you can do to open the person you love up to the possibility of working this out with another is the best thing you can do, because eating disorder, therapy for an eating disorder, isn't just about changing the behaviors. It's about examining the underlying reasons for the disorder.
In your, if you can take yourself out of the equation for just a moment, in your research about binge eating and anorexia, what was something that you learned that you didn't know?
Let's see. I mean, the book is really, you know, a personal memoir. It's my personal story. So it's not not a work of research per se. But I will say that I was surprised about at the paucity of research when it comes to exact numbers of people who suffer from these diseases. Mm-hmm. So for instance, there's a statistic on the internet that binge eating is more common, that, you know, X number of times more common than anorexia and bulimia combined. And when I sort of went down the rabbit hole trying to report out that number, it was really hard to do so. There's lots of research on eating disorders, but that research tends to be less well-funded than research on other mental illnesses like, you know, anxiety or depression, and eating disorders can be just as destructive.
Can you spot someone with a disordered eating or an eating disorder if you're in a room or in a party?
It is something I notice. I mean, sure. I mean, I'm very attuned to watching people eat, and you know, when I watch people eat, I'm not going into it sort of hunting for somebody
sure,
with an eating
sure.
disorder. But I'm usually watching people eat because they're eating so normally. You know, like that's what I want. I just want to like eat food in a normal way. And sometimes I'll see somebody who you know, I'll wonder if you know, is she like me? And it's often a woman. But I think I never assume. But I often wonder for sure.
I can remember talking about this with someone, and I think we came down to the idea that if you saw somebody counting almonds, you know what I mean when I say that.
I know. Well, there
right?
was that New York Times, you know, cover story where Barack Obama was eating 7 almonds. that was his snack, right? It was 7 almonds, and then that became a number to fixate on.
My guest is Susan Burton. The name of her memoir is Empty. You know, right now there are people who are struggling with disordered eating, and I'm sure the stress of what we've all been going through can't have made it easier in any way. What is something that you know about the struggle of disordered eating when you're in a situation with a lot of pressure and a lot of stress that you would like other people to understand?
Well, I mean, you know, to connect it to like the current moment, right? Like, so eating disorders, they thrive in isolation. And the thing with the pandemic is that we're all being encouraged to isolate for our own safety and the safety of others. And we're often isolating at home where there's a kitchen. So it's just a really rough mix. And I would say reach out, connect with somebody else. If it's, you know, if it's somebody who can talk to you about your eating disorder, great. But if it's not something you can open up about, or the, you know, person on the other end isn't somebody who will necessarily understand, just connect, just be in contact with another. Because in an eating disorder, food comes to stand in for people. And anything you do to, you know, sort of move yourself toward relatedness, move yourself toward people will help.
The name of the memoir is Empty. It is by Susan Burton. Susan, thank you so much for spending so much time with us today on All of It.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Allison.